Before we get into today's episode, I want to let you know about a free ebook for you to download today that you won't want to miss. It's called In Conversation with Jordan Peterson, Atheism, Christianity, and the Psychology of Belief. This special ebook was created from an unbelievable podcast with famed Canadian psychologist Jordan Peterson. And in it, you'll discover how to bring order to a chaotic world using the wisdom of the Bible. So download your free copy of In Conversation with Jordan Peterson by visiting premierinsight.org/resources. That's premierinsight.org/resources. This is a limited time offer, so make sure to do it today. That's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast.
Well, hello and welcome along to this week's edition of Unbelievable with me, Justin Briley, the show that aims to get you thinking, bringing you important conversations every week. And today we'll be meeting an atheist TikTok hypnotist and a Christian illusionist as we ask, is Christianity a trick of the mind? I'll be introducing them very shortly. I hope you had a really good Easter weekend last weekend, though, and our big conversation got off to a flying start with Alex O'Connor and Bishop Barron debating God, faith and suffering. Lots of views of the YouTube video. Thanks to all those who have also completed that survey as well. Good to see all those responses coming in. And don't forget, you can go to thebigconversation.show for the exclusive video content from that debate as well. It was a good Easter weekend, though. It was nice to have a little bit of sunshine, and also the lessening of the restrictions here in the UK meant that we could actually meet up with people outside for the first time in quite a long time, actually. So that was good. I also had the pleasure this last week of hosting a live discussion evening for Spring Harvest at Home, asking the question, do we need to rethink worship in the age of COVID-19? I think the most exciting thing about it, though, was actually getting to drive somewhere to a studio in Reading with my wife Lucy for the first time, the way we'd actually been out anywhere in months, so that was a bit of a novelty, and seeing people face to face. But that will actually be airing on Unbelievable in a few weeks' time, so look out for that. I'll tell you a bit more about it later on in the show. Of course, you can find out more about today's program at our show page, premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. Links also there to our upcoming conference on Saturday, the 15th of May. We've just released the seminar topics on the website, so go and have a browse at unbelievable.live. You can see all the speakers and all the seminar topics, and it's going to be a really fantastic day as we learn how to tell the greatest story ever told with the likes of N.T. Wright, Tom Holland, Claire Williams, and Sean and Josh McDowell. Book your place, unbelievable.live, for Saturday, the 15th of May. Right now, time to get into today's edition of the show.
You're listening to Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Well, today on the show, we're asking, is Christianity a trick of the mind? I've got a hypnotist and an illusionist joining me on the show today, so this should be fun. Zach Pinsent is a former believer. He lost his faith after growing doubts about Christianity, after he'd begun pursuing a career in hypnotism. Well, he knows, in a sense, just how suggestible we are, and says, well, religious belief can often work the same way, the same kind of psychological basis. So that's one of the things we'll be talking about on today's show. In defense of Christianity today is Brian Drake. He's a stage illusionist who has toured his act around the USA and beyond, and has often used magic and entertainment to share the Christian faith with his audiences. So today we'll be asking whether Christianity is an illusion based on wishful thinking, or whether Jesus is the real deal, someone who really pulled off the greatest reappearing act in the whole of history, if you'll forgive me for the corny illusion reference, guys. It's so good.
The cornier the better. Let's do
absolutely.
It.
Absolutely. Yeah, you guys know all about corniness from, you know, being on stage and everything.
No, we have a bad rap. It's true. Yeah.
No, I think...
I have no spirals behind me, at least. We're not going that corny.
I think some of those really bad kind of stage acts are long in the back mirror these days. I'm always stunned when I see what people can do these days. You know, Dynamo, Derren Brown.
Sure.
These guys are just... It's just mind-blowing, isn't it, what modern stage illusion hypnotism can be like. But let's talk to you both and introduce you to our audience. First of all, Zach, welcome along to the show. We met each other over TikTok, believe it or not. So
Absolutely.
You've become something of a...
One of your videos just popped up in my feed, and I said, hey, this is interesting. I'll watch this. I made a response, and we started conversing through the comments, and now here we are.
That's the way it works these days, isn't it? Tell us a little bit about what you do on TikTok, and generally how you began in your own hypnotism career as well.
Yeah, so my background was initially in magic, kind of similar to what you do now, Brian, and eventually I started getting into other types of entertainment. I enjoyed it so much that I was like, let's try other things. Let's do improv comedy, stand-up comedy. I'll learn hypnosis because I've always thought it was really neat. But that was the one that I enjoyed the most, and so I thought, you know what? I'm just going to go with that, and I'm going to be a hypnotist. I was learning it my final year of college, and I was a communication major, so I didn't have a direct trajectory. So I thought, you know what? I have no idea if this is going to work out or not. I don't know how to be a full-time hypnotist, but I thought, why not try? And so I went in and started learning how to do it. I got certified through the National Guild of Hypnotists, started doing shows, and social media was how I started putting myself out there. Started on YouTube initially, and then TikTok was the one that really helped me to build my platform to where it is now, where a lot of my videos have gone viral, and I've been able to work with a lot of cool social media celebrities out here in LA where I live because of that platform. But yeah, I just started learning, and social media is where I could put myself out there and put those videos there to really show what I do, and now get to the point where I can go do shows and tour around when, of course, there's not a pandemic. I'm sure Brian, you can relate to those struggles.
I was going
to
say that.
Just want to get back on the stage right now.
That's right.
I mean, for those who aren't as hip and with it as we all are, what is TikTok, just for those who don't know, Zach?
Sure. I think the easiest way to describe it would be like a shorter version of YouTube, right? You think of YouTube as kind of like a video library where you can look up whatever content you want. TikTok, all the videos are 60 seconds or shorter. And TikTok is formatted in a way where it's just a single video on the screen. You think about YouTube, you go on the YouTube homepage and there's all these different videos recommended. TikTok's one video. If you like it, you watch it. And when it's done, you scroll to the next one. If you don't like it, you scroll to the next one. And it's just very streamlined, focused, which is great. And it gets people hooked because it's that constant dopamine of what's the next video. What's the next? There's always something you haven't seen and swipe away. And so it's so easy to just get caught in that platform.
Kind of doing to YouTube what Twitter did to the blogosphere almost. It's like, you know, that instant hit, kind of, you know, keep them coming. I was surprised at how quickly some of my videos took off, but it's all down to my 16-year-old son, who is the king of TikTok, so I'm not going to claim any glory myself.
Your TikTok manager.
Exactly, yeah. Anyway, it's great to have you on the show. We're going to hear a bit about your story, obviously, in just a moment, Zach, but Brian, welcome to the show as well. How long have you been in the entertainment and illusion business yourself?
Yeah, the illusion business. It always sounds funny. It sounds fake when you say it like that, but I found a picture actually this week of when I was, I think, 19, so I'm 34 now, so 15 years I've been dabbling in this. You know, I was interested as a kid, kind of the classic cliche story, but I wasn't that interested. It was just like, you know, it was the same as like pro wrestling and skateboarding stuff in the 90s. It was just stuff that was around, you know? But I got interested in it because I thought how much fun it would be just to do these crazy close-up card tricks and things like that. And so 19 years old, I grabbed a deck of cards, the birth of like YouTube and early video hosting things were out there, and people were just sharing how to do these tricks and illusions. And so I learned, and I would just go around my college campus and show everybody every new trick I had learned, to the detriment of my grades and to where I failed accounting because I was in the back of the room with like a book. I was like, oh, that's how you palm a card. And I saw the board. I was like, I'm never going to use that. And so thankfully, my wife Carla handles all of our numbers and things like that for our ministry right now, which is great because obviously I have no skill set in that. But I was a junior high youth pastor at the time, about 20, 21 years old, and I realized that I started wanting to do stage stuff, which I always rejected at first because in my mind it was sequins and dancing. Mm. And I was like, I don't want anything to do with that. But I was the junior high youth pastor, and on Wednesday nights I was like, well, wait a minute. I've got a captive audience. Where are they going to go? Yeah. You know, so I just forced them to watch tricks on Wednesday night to illustrate the point that we were going to do. And they were terrible. They were some of the worst. If I could find footage of that, I wish I could sometimes. But my wife, Carla's like, please don't find footage of that because it was bad.
Oh, wow. So that's where it all started, though, at a youth group, basically. And yeah, amazing. Amazing. I mean, you now tour, you know, all over the place. Obviously, COVID has put a stop to a lot of that in the past year. I think things are just starting to pick up again, though, for you, aren't they? So what would a night look like that you're putting on, you know, maybe on a university campus or somewhere? What would that do?
So a lot of times we'll come in that afternoon and we'll go around and do close-up stuff at lunch and just say, hey, check out the show tonight over in such and such room, or where, if it's at a church, we'll, you know, it'll be a school assembly. Hey, stay in school, make good choices. But also there's going to be the show tonight you're invited to. Then we'll get there a couple hours early, you know, 3 or 4 hours early, and we'll set up the show. And that's the cool part. My wife, Carla, is the other half of the show. She doesn't speak on stage. That horrifies her, the idea of it. But she makes the magic happen, like in our show. So we have a two-person show that looks like a one-person show much more. And so she does all of that kind of stuff. And so she'll set it up, and then I just basically run my mouth on stage for an hour and a half. But I'm an evangelist at heart. And so in that, we share the gospel through that. We give the opportunity to respond through that. And so it's been cool, because we've been on the road full time together for 11 years this year.
Yeah,
so
great.
It's been wild.
I don't suppose you have a trick you could show us on camera now, do you?
Yeah. I mean, we can try something. Yeah, as tight as... Let's see. I'll tell you what.
This is only going to help the people watching on video. So apologies to all of those who are listening on podcast. We'll just describe what's happening on screen right now.
That's it. The ultimate plug for the video right there for the podcasters and radio. So, hey, I'll tell you what, you name a card. We'll do it like that. You tell me which card you want to use.
I don't know. The three of diamonds.
That's not a real card. No, three of diamonds. Okay, three of diamonds right here. So, Justin, are you right-handed or left-handed?
I'm right-handed. Okay. Right-handed.
Okay, so we're going to stick your card towards the middle of the deck, old school now, right? We're going to stick it towards the middle. Now, I'm going to give it a cut like this. Now, anytime you snap your fingers, your card's going to come to the top of the deck. It's not there yet, mm-hmm, correct? Mm-hmm. That is not the three of diamonds. Mm-hmm. Perfect. Here we go, on three. Ready? One, two, three. Snap your fingers. Amazing. Look at that. The three of diamonds right there on top of the deck. Now, I know what you're thinking. Let's do it again. Put it towards the middle again.
Okay.
One, two, three.
Yeah.
Boom. Just like that. Excellent job, Justin. Now, I know we're going to do it visually this time. I know I can tell you're just uberly impressed right now, but we're going to make it visually happen this time.
Okay. Here we go.
Stick it towards the middle. This is not it, correct? This is the three of clubs, but watch closely here. The three of clubs. There we go. Just like that is the three of diamonds.
Wow.
So,
wow.
Wonderful.
Amazing.
And for those of you listening at home, it was just as amazing as it sounded.
You're going to have to just go and see that to believe it. Okay. Wow. I've always wanted to see some up close magic. I haven't seen much of that in my life. But anyway, that is a great introduction to you, Brian and Zach. If you want to go and check these guys out on their social media, @ZachPinSince and @BrianDrakeShow is where you need to go. But let's get into the meat of this, because we're here to talk about whether Christianity itself is an illusion, a trick of the mind, as it were. And to do that, we're going to start with your story, Zach. So you were a pretty committed Christian by all accounts. So just tell us what happened. Why did faith slip away? And this was only relatively recently, I think, wasn't it, Zach?
It was. Yeah, it was around a year ago this time. So it's almost my atheist anniversary, if that's even a thing, right? Thinking about the idea. But yeah, so I grew up in a very, very Christian home. Grew up going to Sunday school and youth group and in church. And I was even homeschooled growing up and was homeschooled under a Christian curriculum with Bible studies every year. And so I was not just like grew up Christian, but was completely immersed in it. And it never, at no point in my life did I ever have any doubts. It was just something that I was just new. Mm-hmm. God was real. Jesus came back from the dead. That was just that. And that was my life, right? And it was something that started to become more personal and real as I started to become more of a teenager and then graduating and going out of the house and going off to college. And it was one of those things where, oh, this was something I grew up with. But the more I took it on as my own belief in faith, it just only grew even more. Mm-hmm. And even in college, I was a part of my college's campus ministry. I was a president of the campus ministry for most of my time there, was leading Bible studies and preaching in the large group meetings and was bringing students to faith. And at one point in college, I almost even considered going into ministry as a full-time job because I loved it so much and was so committed to my faith. And then the tables turned and I decided to go into hypnosis. So a little bit different, right? But I was completely immersed in it growing up, and it was never something that I doubted, and there was never any points where I was like, no, God's not real. Of course he is. And I grew up reading, Lee Strobel and the C.S. Lewis and Josh McDowell and all of these books. So not only did I have the faith, but I grew up reading all of these books and all this information and all this this back knowledge. If someone ever, you know, asked me these questions, or if I had this kind of conversation with someone else, I would be able to quote all these things off the top of my head, or quote these Bible verses, and knew how to defend my faith really well. Mm-hmm. And so it wasn't until I started getting into, you know, the real world after you graduate college, right? Going into hypnosis, but specifically questioning the idea of, like, what does it look like to live out my faith? What does it look like to actually be a Christian in the 21st century? Thinking about this idea of, well, I can think of the things that I would do tangibly, right? You know, I go to church, I read my Bible, I pray. But I was really asking myself that, like, what does it look like differently based in the way that I live my life or the way that I treat people? But what would set me apart from, let's say, an atheist who is really kind and caring and loves others and lives their life for other people versus me as a Christian that does that? And it's the only thing that separates me, just those religious experiences like church and prayer and reading the Bible. And if those are the only things that separate me, how am I any different than the Pharisees, the people that Jesus was the most pissed off at in the Bible? And so I was really wrestling with this idea of, what does it look like to live out my faith? And through that whole point, I never had any doubts. I never started thinking God's not real or Jesus didn't come back from the dead. It was more just sort of a reconstructing of what does my faith look like? And then, of course, as I got into the hypnosis, starting to understand the ideas of how people can construct beliefs. Literally, me as a hypnotist, where I give somebody something to believe that's not true and they suddenly believe it. How weird or how crazy is that? But also looking at the idea of trance and the idea of getting people into a focused state and starting to look at some of these parallels of church, right? And church being a very hypnotic experience where you let yourself get completely immersed in a worship experience, or when you pray, you're letting yourself become immersed in the idea of conversing with God or hearing his voice. And not that, again, that caused me to have any doubt, but I was just realizing, you know, if this wasn't true, I could see how people could be convinced that it was, but I still think that it's true. God's still real, and I still believe it myself, but was still sort of looking at some of that application and unpacking some of those ideas. Then it was around this time last year where a good friend of mine, his name is Matt Vaughn, he had a conversation with me about my faith, and he was an atheist, and I was a Christian, and we were going back and forth about it. And at one point, I was like, you know, I'm still sort of unpacking what it means to be a Christian, but to me, the reason that I still believe is because Jesus actually came back from the dead. He was resurrected. This thing happened 2,000 years ago. And although I'm still trying to figure out what it means, what it looks like, how I live my life because of that thing, the fact that that thing happened has very serious real ramifications, which to me means I still believe in God and I'm still a Christian and I still hold on to that faith, even if I'm still trying to figure out what that looks like and how to apply it in my life and in my career and what I do. And he came back to me just saying, well, there actually isn't that evidence for the resurrection. It's not there. And in my mind, I'm like, of course there is. I've read The Case for Christ, and I've read all of these books, and I know that there is. But he challenged me to go actually look at the information that was out there. And to me, I'm thinking, okay, I'll go look at this information and find all this evidence and come back to you about it and be able to just make my faith even stronger because, hey, you said there's this information that disproves it. Well, okay, I'll look into it, but I'm pretty sure the information that I know is pretty accurate. So I go and I do my own research, but I do not with the mindset of, oh, I want to just prove that what I know is true. I was trying to be as open and as fair as possible. I just want to go look at the information and see what conclusion it brings. This either happened or it didn't, and the information will either back it up or it won't. And so I go in, and spoiler alert, I found that the information didn't quite back it up in the way that I thought it did. And all of this information and all of these reasons that I thought I had all quickly fell apart when I started looking at the other side of the arguments and also realizing that these arguments I had come across were ones that I was never exposed to growing up.
Yeah.
That I had read all of these Christian books and then all of these Bible studies and trainings, and yet how have I never heard these other arguments? And sort of just laid on this feeling of being duped, right? Of like, wait a minute, why did I only ever hear one side of the story? Because now that I've heard both sides, the other side actually sounds a lot more intellectually honest. And so it came to the point where I realized that it actually makes a lot more sense and it feels a lot more intellectually honest to come to the conclusion that the resurrection is something that didn't happen and not that it's something that did. And to me, once that piece fell out of the picture, there was no reason to hold on to my faith anymore. Even as a Christian, I believe that, you know, like Paul says in 1 Corinthians, if Christ is not raised, your faith is in vain. And so the resurrection truly is a cornerstone to a belief as a Christian. And when that piece, you know, that the rug was pulled out from under me, it was like, all right, what reason is there to hold on to this anymore? And so decided to then identify as an atheist going forward. And it's still something that I'm really passionate about and care about. Yeah. That's why
I'm here talking about it.
As a Christian, I always enjoyed those spiritual conversations. Now as an atheist, I do
and
too.
And I'm aware you haven't really had many of these kinds of conversations yet either.
Not from the other side, at least.
Yeah,
exactly. This is kind of exciting.
Exactly. Yeah. So thank you for coming on the show to share your story, because obviously this is, if you like, you know, a first time to kind of talk about this in a very public way, in that way.
Thank you for having me.
Well, we're going to sort of obviously come to the resurrection stuff, I think, a little bit later on. Before we get there, though, Brian, I just wonder, first of all, maybe your thoughts on Zach's story overall. But do you find that skepticism, if you like, around religion is maybe more common in the illusion magic community? Because I guess I think of people like Derren Brown, and as you'll know, I've had him on the show before a few times, but equally Penn and Teller, quite well known as being quite anti-religious almost, and so on. So is this something you'd say is widespread, or is that more just that, you know, you tend to see these well-known people and some of them are anti-religious, Brian?
Yeah, it's really a mixed bag, because there are a ton of illusionists who would consider themselves secular illusionists who are believers. There's a guy in the UK who's very popular. He's been on TV here in the States, named John Archer, who's a believer. Richard Osterlund is a very famous in our circle mentalist who's also a believer. So it's kind of mixed. I mean, I know there's just two examples, but to your point, there does seem to be a cadre of people who really have a, it's not so much the hardcore anti-theism that we had back in the mid-2000s, early, you know, 2010s and stuff. It's more now to the point of almost an apathetic atheism. It just doesn't matter, to where it's obviously not true, therefore, because of this, you know, this and this, and the illusion industry is why I don't believe it. Now, that pendulum swings all the way to the other side. And Zach, I'm sure you know Jeff McBride. He considers himself an actual shaman, like a real, like, what I'm doing is a piece of the real. And so that pendulum can swing all over the place. But there does seem to be a bit of skepticism because of the nature of what we do. Now, the first words out of my mouth on stage, doesn't matter if the crowd's, you know, 100 people or 2,000 people or whatever, is, hey, everything you're about to see is fake. It's not real. I mean, you could learn how to do what I'm doing given time and practice and lack of social skills. You know what I'm saying? Like, that's what I always say. But I think there's a bigger Venn diagram circle than you would find in the normal just population. But I do think there tends to be a little bit of skepticism, but you'd also be surprised by how many people aren't in that same
pool. I mean, when it comes to hearing something of Zach's own story, then what's your reaction to that? Obviously, maybe fairly typical in some ways of people who, you know, kind of after they've grown up a bit, left college, hit the real world, and suddenly, okay, Christianity isn't exactly the way my church or my parents described it to me. But I know it's a bit deeper than that, obviously, Zach. But the in a way, you know, it sounds, Zach, like you're saying, did the hypnotism itself? I mean, I know that the resurrection issue was obviously key, but did the hypnotism itself that you were doing kind of take you in that direction as well, in terms of thinking actually this is kind of more of a psychological thing and so on?
Yeah, the hypnosis sort of opened my eyes up to looking at my faith differently, and I still held on to my faith. So I wouldn't say, I still could have been a hypnotist and a Christian, and those things still could have coexisted, even with all that I knew about hypnosis. The resurrection being the big linchpin that was, all right, now I go from Christian to atheist. But hypnosis really opened my eyes up to reconstructing it and rethinking about it and looking at my faith from a different perspective and really understanding how we form and connect our beliefs. And like I mentioned earlier, this idea of, I still think this is true, but if it weren't, I could see exactly how people could believe that it was true. So I was putting the puzzle pieces together, but because of the resurrection and my belief in it at that time, even despite me seeing how it could potentially not be true, that was one of the big reasons why I still held on to it. And then that belief coming out from
And Zach mentioned earlier, Brian, almost the hypnotic effect almost you can get in some churches, you know, being caught up in the worship experience and so on. So what's your response to all that side of things before we get to the resurrection thing?
Absolutely. Yeah, and we may have to not expose the business, but we may have to break into the kayfabe a little bit of the techniques, because I'd like to kind of parse out what we were just talking about there. If, for instance, just because someone can be swept up, and we've seen this, people can be swept up into emotion in church services that are based in things that aren't accurate or things that aren't real. I think of a lot of the movements in the spiritual, even the spiritualist movements of the 1870s and stuff, how they mixed in the occult with it, and yet people were just worshiping along with it, thinking it was the same thing as what they'd always known. But just because something has been used incorrectly, does it change first century Christianity? It would be my question. You know, just because you can play an amazing elevation worship song and get people really, maybe some emotion behind it and hands raised and things, does it change the core truths of the gospel? And I would say that the practice like that doesn't really so much affect the core truth of the gospel in the first place. But as far as hypnotism goes, I would push back a little bit. Now, Zach, you didn't make this claim, but I would ask you, with what you know of hypnotism, what I know of hypnotism, do you think it's possible that someone could nefariously have a large movement based on hypnotism, or are you mostly associating the idea of forming beliefs in our brains in a personal way?
Yeah, I look at hypnosis much more loosely than what I do on stage, right? What I do on stage is a more direct, all right, I put people into a trance, I give them suggestions, they do those suggestions after the state, like show is over, I take them out of trance, and that's hypnosis in a very confined way. But to me, I look at hypnosis as simplified as possible, the idea of how we construct our beliefs. Because when I'm doing that, I'm putting people into a more believable open state and giving them a suggestion they believe. So to me, I look at hypnosis of this idea of believing something with complete conviction that it's true. Whether that's something I'm doing to somebody on stage, whether that's the ability to make your life better, overcome a fear, quit smoking, lose weight, whether it's getting caught up in a religion, whatever it is, I look at hypnosis much more loosely of the idea of a belief that you hold with absolute certainty. Because we all know that people can believe something that's not true, but if they believe it like it is, they'll experience it and live their life as if it is. So I look at that idea of hypnotic, not in the sense of they're getting put into a mass trance and getting suggestions that are altering their mind in a nefarious way, but more so how they align their life in what they believe in a way that any other religion does, not just Christianity specifically, but you think of any religion, people commit their lives to believing that religion. And as Christians, you might say everyone else who believes the other religions is caught up in some sort of mindset, or they're focused on the belief, even though they might say it's not true. So getting into this idea of that hypnosis being something that we believe with certainty and how that belief affects our life and our experience.
Sure. Now, just to push back for a second, what I hear in that, though, seems to be kind of a nice form of the genetic fallacy, in a sense, to where, and I'm not saying you're committing that, but I'm saying that, yes, that's an interesting question, how we form those beliefs in our mind. But if I, for instance, form the belief that 2 + 2 = 4 out of some sort of religious experience, and I have that, it doesn't change the fact that 2 + 2 = 4, and not even for Lawrence Krauss with his t-shirt bit, But
and of course, I'm not saying that this is something that would disprove or prove it either way.
Oh, no,
I understand. This is more just, for me, was like, this is really interesting, because gotcha. I still thought it was true, of course, even in spite of all of that. But I was like, if it wasn't true, this is really interesting to see how it could persuade people that it's not, or even paralleling that to every other religious experience other than my own, similar experiences, but I could see how they all have same type of worship prayer experience. But it was not until I got to the resurrection that not only did that remove the belief, but then now sort of retracing that lines, I can look back as a hypnotist and see, all right, now as an atheist, I can see how I believed that psychologically. Even though now I'm convinced it wasn't true, I could see how I thought
it was. We're going to go to a quick break, and we'll be back and hear what Zach has to say in response, and indeed Brian, to these questions around hypnotism, illusion, belief, and everything else. We're talking about whether ultimately Christianity is a trick of the mind on Unbelievable today. My guests are Zach Pinsent and Brian Drake, and we'll be back in just a moment.
Listening to Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
We're talking about, is Christianity a trick of the mind on the show today? Zach Pinsent and Brian Drake join me. Zach basically was a Christian, but lost his faith, partly because of his growing career in hypnotism, but also because he came to doubt the resurrection. Brian Drake, a stage illusionist who takes his show all over the USA and beyond and actually uses it as a way of sharing the gospel with people, is here to respond on behalf of Christianity, if you like. And I get what Zach was saying there in that last section, Brian, which is essentially, look, even though for a time at least he was still a Christian, but recognizing the way that people could be influenced by, you know, the sights and sounds and, you know, atmosphere of a church and everything else. And as you said, that doesn't make the belief false. You can still believe something even if you arrived at that belief in a slightly strange or non-rational way, let's say. I suppose for you then, I guess firstly, there's the question of, should we be careful in church that we're not, if you like, pulling on those kind of emotional sort of strings too much, if you like, when it comes to the way we put our faith across. But equally, how do we hold on to a faith that isn't, you know, in a sense, based in those kinds of experiences and that kind of thing?
No, absolutely. And I think this is somewhere that Zach and I will have quite a bit of common ground, is the idea that there are charlatans out there who do, in fact, use the name of Christ and Christianity and to prey on people for their emotions. They'll use it for emotions and things like that. Now, as a Christian, I believe that God gives us emotions. God gives us, you know, a sense of humor, all these sorts of things. But there have been times we've seen the video clips before with the faith healing kind of exposed stuff in the, you know, 70s, 80s, 90s with the earpieces. And, you know, you can hear, was it Peter Popoff's wife, I believe, saying to him what he needs to say. And I'm getting a voice from the Lord. And things like that are, it's beyond angering to me as someone who is a professing Christian to see someone who uses mentalism techniques. They're basically doing what's called a question and answer act, essentially. And they're doing a mentalist act under the guise of, hey, this is real. And not only is it real, it's from God, and I can help you using this. And that's very frustrating for me as a Christian who believes and uses illusion to share the gospel. Because, I mean, with what we do, and this is one of the things that's actually cemented my faith, is one of the things we do in the show, is that if I have you think of a name, right, and I write down a prediction on stage, and it just so happens that that name is accurate, well, there's infinite wrong names, but there's only one right name, which leads us to the idea that there is objective truth. No one's impressed if I say, you were thinking of the word Daniel, right? She says, no, I was thinking Elizabeth, and the crowd would go wild. Well, absolutely not. That's not impressive at all. It's only impressive because there's infinite wrong names, but only one right name. And so that little piece, just one little notion, is one of the things that submitted my faith, that there is objective truth out there, and objective, which obviously leads to a moral argument and things like that further down the line. But but again, it's frustrating to see it abused.
Absolutely. I guess there are instances in which people wouldn't necessarily be consciously even abusing it. There's ways in which, you know, we might sort of do things and not realize that it's having some. But at the same, by the same token, I mean, I obviously am a Christian coming into this act, and I don't. I think if there is a God, that God would speak to us through our emotions as well as our intellect. So I don't think, for me, it's a problem necessarily that people get emotional in a worship service, because that's part of what it is to be human. So in a sense, it's not that you're anti-emotion at all, presumably, Zach, when it comes to these sorts of issues.
No, of course. And I don't mean by the religious experience in a church, I'm not talking about just emotions. I'm talking about more of the focus on the idea that you believe in. Okay. Right? Let's say, for example, if you were a flat earther and you believe that the earth is flat, right? If you spend all of your time constantly going to flat earth meetings and always talking about how the earth is flat and always looking into this information and singing songs together about how the earth is flat and putting your mind in a state that the earth is flat, and if I really think about this and I can really, you know, communicate with the spirits or whatever, how the evidence of the earth is flat, right? It's a hypnotic type of way of state that you're putting yourself in. It's not just emotional, but it's letting yourself get sort of immersed in this bubble of what you believe in. And whether that's something that's religious or non-religious, it doesn't matter. It, of course, can be applied to religion, but it can be applied to everything else. So I see it in more of like allowing yourself to be wrapped up with that sort of tunnel vision of, oh, I know my faith is real, and so I'm going to continue to just focus and build that. And again, not that there's anything wrong with that, or that it proves or disproves anything, but I can see how anybody that allows himself to be immersed in what they believe will continue to believe that unless they're challenged, or they start to think outside of the box or critically think, like, what if this isn't true? If you're always convincing yourself that it is, then you'll always believe it whether or not it really is true.
What do you think of that, Brian?
No, I think you're right. In a sense there, even though we come at it from two different angles, I agree that students especially, but even adults, need to be challenged in their faith. I mean, confirmation bias is such a dangerous thing that can happen in anything. It's how cults form. It's how dangerous movements form by confirmation bias, you know? And so if you grow up in a church, or let's say you grew up in, you know, 1981 Soviet Russia, and all you knew is this one thing, never having that view challenged is a dangerous thing, because you, when you do realize that this mindset you have is false or has issues or there's holes in what you've been taught or what you believe, you're not going to be prepared for how to deal with that. And so that doesn't sound like necessarily that was your story, because it sounds like you were coming from it from a, hey, I want to be analytical, I want to observe it. But you did start to take your faith more seriously before you lost it. You start to own it. I think that's one of the things that we as a church have gotten better about in the last 20 years, especially, but can continue to grow in that area of, let's make sure that we're not just, oh, no, don't talk about that topic. You know, stay away from that topic. We don't want you to accidentally fall into atheism or something. No, we should address that topic. You know, we shouldn't run away from, you know, age of the earth things. Yes, those are tertiary and they don't affect us, you know, primarily. But, you know, let's talk about Reformed theology. Let's talk about, you know, racial reconciliation and things. Let's talk about these issues as a church instead of just running from them and say, okay, where's the truth? Let's find truth in this issue unified, instead of just going, well, this is what we've always believed, so let's continue to do that.
Yeah. I think the biggest thing has to come down to being willing to entertain the other side, right? And sure, this goes for both sides. As an atheist, as a Christian, if I'm an atheist and I'm like, I don't care what evidence you say to me, Christianity can't be true, it isn't right, true, God is real, and I continue to focus on that, don't even entertain the possibility, that's intellectually dishonest. Same thing as a Christian or in any religion, right? If you say, oh, well, I can hear your arguments, but they're whatever, because I know that I'm right and nothing could ever convince me otherwise, right? I've had conversations with Christians where I say, out of curiosity, like, what could change your mind or what might change your mind? And they were like, I could hear the best arguments in the world, but I would still just know that that's the devil trying to lead me away from Jesus. It's like, well, okay, that's not being intellectually honest or fair. You have to be willing to entertain the possibility that you're wrong. And you may not be, but you have to at least entertain that.
And I would agree, Zach, but I, by the same token, I've spoken to atheists who, when I've asked them the same question, what could make you even consider the possibility that God may exist or Christianity may be true, they've said, I genuinely can't think of anything, because I think they are very wedded, in a sense, to their worldview. Now, so here's my challenge, I suppose, to you, Zach. You've labeled yourself, you've talked about yourself as an atheist now, which is interesting, because that's quite a quick turnaround, in the sense, and given that what you stopped believing in was Christianity, really, is obviously you feel you've gone that much further. You just don't believe in God at all at this point. What has led you to that specific, if you like, outlook, that worldview, if you like? And to an extent, don't you need to kind of also be willing to show evidence that that is true? You know, because I'm wondering why you're not more just a kind of, well, I don't know now, and an agnostic in that sense.
Yeah, more on the agnostic versus atheist. Yeah. And I would say that everybody who is an atheist and everybody who is a theist, I would say technically all fall in the umbrella of being some sort of agnostic, right? Because we can't prove with absolute certainty that God exists or that any specific God exists. And we can't prove with absolute certainty that he doesn't exist. So none of us know for certain, right? Even in the definition of theist or anti-atheist, we would be saying that there's a claim that this does exist or it doesn't. And I think if Richard Dawkins, in his book, The God Delusion, lays out this scale, right, of everybody on a certain level of agnosticism, and he even calls himself, like, hey, he's pretty up there on that scale, but nobody can ever reach the high or the low of that scale because we can't know for sure. So as an atheist, even though there's still things that I don't know and will never know for sure, I still piece all the information together and say, what is most likely? And that's what I think we all have to do when we create these beliefs, is sometimes we can't know for sure, but what's most likely is that God exists or that he doesn't. And so I've gotten to the conclusion through the things that I've read and all the information that I've learned in my life up to this point, that it seems more likely that there isn't a God than that there is. And there still could be. I could be mistaken. I could be wrong. Maybe I haven't seen the right information. So I still remain open to that possibility. But based on what I know now, it seems pretty likely that God doesn't, which is why I sort of fall on that camp of being an atheist versus being agnostic or being an open theist or whatever that may be.
I mean, you've engaged quite a lot with atheists in one form or another, Brian, over the years yourself. Yeah. So what has, you know, after seeing, I guess, a lot of the same arguments against God that Zach has bumped into, has led you to believe, actually, no, what I maybe grew up with has actually got a rational, intellectually strong basis to it?
Yeah, that was the thing. I did grow up in church. I was a Sunday morning, Sunday night, Wednesday night kind of Christian. You know, we were always there. But I kind of had the same experience when I got into college. Justin, you've been around for a long time doing this, but I mean, William Lane Craig and guys like that have been around for, goodness, 30, 40 years almost, doing, you know, ministry that comes to apologetics and the philosophy of Christianity. And so diving into those kind of arguments, the Kalam cosmological argument, the teleological argument, to me, the strongest arguments for Christianity would be the moral argument and then the evidence for the resurrection. And again, as a Christian, but also someone as an illusionist, my question to Zach, and you can come back to it later, you don't have to do it right now, but is, do you find yourself more on that line of a Richard Carrier sort of, there probably isn't a Jesus of Nazareth, period, or is it more, probably was a guy, just didn't rise from the dead? Because I think that really does help us figure out if it's a psychological belief that the disciples had from self-hypnotism, essentially. And I say self-hypnotism, I don't mean that they pressed play and, you know, stopped smoking. I mean, through some sort of experience. But I just don't see it as someone sat them down and gave them a Dave Ellman induction, you know, or a rapid induction or something like that. You know what I mean? I guess the best
example I would use as sort of an analogy of how I see Jesus or the story of it at this point is maybe how I would look at the story of Robin Hood, right? Was there this actual person named Robin of Locksley who existed several hundred years ago? Sure. Were the people and places he interacted with and the stories about him real people, real places? They were. But did everything that happened in the stories happen exactly the ways the stories outlined it? Well, probably not. We can recognize that there are some elements that are maybe myth or maybe were added on, or maybe as the stories continue to grow, they got expounded on to the point where they were unbelievable. No pun intended, right? Being on the podcast. I look at the story of Jesus now the same way. Was there this historical person named Jesus of Nazareth that existed? That's something the historians still debate, but it seems like the consensus is that there was somebody named Jesus who existed. Were the people, the places he interacted with, real people, real places? They were. But did everything that happened in the stories outlined in the Gospels happen in the way that they were described? I see them as a similar way. They seem to be described as stories that would be more miraculous or more mythological or more stories that aren't necessarily accurate with reality, even though they portray real people in real places in real times. We can recognize some of those elements that look like myths or look like stories. And that's what historians have to do, right, is we have to look at these stories that have happened because we can't know for sure what happened. So we look at these stories and say, what's the most probable outcome? What most probably happened here? The problem, though, with stories like the gospel stories is they're filled with miracles. Miracles, with by definition, are the least probable outcome because by being miraculous, they're the least probable. And so when you look at these stories of all of these least probable things that could have happened, there are plenty of other ways that we could sort of fill those gaps of saying, sure, maybe these stories were continued to be expounded upon, like we even see in how there are Gnostic Gospels that Christians don't claim as part of the Bible because the stories continue to get crazier and crazier. So at what point do we say that they were real and this happened, or at what point do they say they were all fables and just continue to get crazier and crazier to the point that even Christians said, no, these are too crazy, versus recognizing them as actual historical fact of these miracles, including the biggest and most important one of all, if it actually happened, the resurrection. So I look at that as more like, not necessarily, oh, it's all just bogus and didn't exist, but how do we recognize the Gospels as historical documents if we take them word for word and they happened, versus how do we interpret them like we might any other ancient historical source and recognize, are they real stories or are they stories that were passed
down? Or was Jesus a fox and Peter a bear, like in the Robin
Hood? Yeah, right. There's no Disney right. Resurrection.
I don't think that would go over so well, but no. And
no, but
thank
they
you
were
for
vegetables,
elaborating.
Right? Yeah. I grew up on veggie tales. That's right.
What do you say then, Brian, in response to all this? Well, I mean, where sure. do you go? I mean, this is obviously, you know, a classic objection to Christianity. Can we trust the documents? Is it, you know, the miracles? Isn't it more likely that these are just, you know, legendary claims that, you know, were passed on and, you know, grew over time. So where do you begin with all of that?
One of the things that really stood out to me in what you just said was the idea that we reject the Gnostic Gospels because they had these miraculous claims that were wilder than the earlier claims. And I'm not so certain that that's why we reject them. We reject them, A, because of dating, and we reject them, A, because of the very much more pseudonymous writing of them. Whereas I personally believe, through the evidence that we have good evidence of, you know, that eyewitness testimonies wrote the Gospels, that Mark relied on, you know, a very early burial and resurrection narrative, you know, or crucifixion resurrection narrative, that Paul in his writing is relaying something that had been around within 18 months to 2 years to six years of the time of the resurrection in 1 Corinthians 15. You know, in Acts, you get the sermon summaries that are clearly oral tradition. Just the breakdown of the narrative of how they're written is clearly something they're citing from earlier. Whereas in history, I feel like that historians, especially, you know, the John Dominic Crossans and the Gert Ludemans and people in the kind of the Jesus Seminar folks, they're a lot more willing to take, well, you know, Caesar stories or stories about Homer and stories about this and that, not more miraculous stories about Homer, but as more, well, this is clearly what the original author meant, even though the wealth of manuscripts is so small in those aspects, and the time between the manuscripts being written is so much further than what we have for the New Testament. I mean, it's a wealth of riches that we have in ancient history for the New Testament, for the documents, and we're, what, 99.9% certain of what the original autograph said, and even those little bits that we're not 100% sure, none of those affect doctrine. Even Bart Ehrman has to admit that, not that he wants to a lot of times, but I really lean on, you know, those four basic facts, that there's the empty tomb, there's the eyewitnesses, there's the post-mortem appearances, and then the very un-Jewish faith that the disciples had so soon after their Messiah was, you know, killed. I mean, they weren't part of some weird sect or cult initially that branched off. They were Jews who were doing Jewish things. I mean, they were in Jerusalem to do Passover. To do Passover that very week that Jesus was crucified. So it's not like they were already rejecting Judaism. They were who they were. And then all of a sudden, within what, 5 weeks, boom, the switch completely changed, and they became, they went out preaching Christ crucified, you know, and that he was resurrected. So I really lean on that. I feel like the evidence has very big explanatory scope and explanatory power versus, you know, picking and saying, well, it could be a swoon, it could be some sort of a twin theory for this and this. I feel like if we had to start applying so many theories to account for all of these early facts, then you start to lose that explanatory power versus, you know, the idea that the resurrection happened. Again, it comes down to, obviously, if God exists, then of course the resurrection is possible. You know what I mean? That's at least where I lie.
Yeah, that's an interesting one, because in a sense, often I find the issue at stake is not so much necessarily, Zach, when it comes to the resurrection, you know, is there good historical evidence that, you know, the disciples had, you know, experiences they believe were of the risen Christ, that women followers discovered an empty tomb, those kinds of things, which, you know, arguably a lot of historians can agree on, you know, the facts around the story. But the kind of the central point is whether you believe a miracle can be, be used as an explanation of historical events. And obviously for someone who does believe in God, that's a possibility. For someone who doesn't, then in a sense, any other explanation is better, because a miracle is kind of out of bounds. Now, do you see that? Do you think that you just shouldn't go down the miracle route, whatever happens, and therefore it's kind of never going to be a good explanation?
I wouldn't say you just completely discount it, right? Because then that's being intellectually dishonest, of saying, I'm going to throw at this conclusion because I don't like it or it's too supernatural, right? But I think if we are trying to be intellectually honest, that should not be the first one that we jump to, right? We should try to find, what are all the other possible natural explanations for how this could have happened? And I think the challenge or the problem that I see with a lot of these arguments, and I know you started to bring up some of the minimal facts, and I know we could definitely dive into some of those and why I think they carry weight or why they don't. But I think at the end of the day, a lot of those arguments come from the place of presupposing the conclusion, right? We assume that Jesus was resurrected because we believed in God, and because we believe in God, that's a possibility. So we take the conclusion and we start to find the facts and see how they can support the conclusion, versus actually reasoning and saying, let's look at all the facts, let's look at all the data, what's out there, And what conclusion does this data, do these facts, lead us to? Now, if we can honestly look at these facts and say that the most likely scenario based on the facts that we have is a supernatural miracle, then great. But if we can look at these facts and we can say, well, there are all of these other possibilities. Here's a natural explanation for how this could have happened or how this could have happened. And as we dive into those specifics, you know, I could even get into some of those. Oh, here's how you could explain how this could have happened or this could have happened or this could have happened despite these facts. Here are all good natural explanations that may not necessarily require supernatural explanation being necessary. But I think that's the biggest thing, is we want to be reasoning as honest as possible, looking at the data and letting the data take us where it goes, not using the data to support what we already know, because we all know, right? Anybody can prove anything if we just assume a conclusion and try to fit that data into the conclusion. So how do we be as intellectually fair as possible?
I'll pass this back to you in a moment, Brian, but then in a sense, I'd be interested in just like what would be your best theory at this point of how the Christian movement got going? Because as Brian said, it's very unusual for Jewish people to start believing that the Messiah had been crucified and then risen. That was a strange belief to have invented, arguably. So why did suddenly this movement start proclaiming this? What's your best theory, naturalistic theory, if you like, for why this all started?
Sure. Well, you can look at how any other religion starts, right? And all it takes for any other major religion to start is literally one or two people really believing it. Right. If you look at, you know, something like Islam, and you look at Muhammad and claiming to have the revelations from Allah and writing them down and the followers growing, or you look at someone like Joseph Smith and finding these golden tablets and spreading this information, how did these millions and millions of people start believing these things? Well, it all sort of funnels back to the experience of one or two people. And now if you start to get into the possibility of, all right, what if the only people that actually had experiences in real life were Peter and Paul? Because we know historically, right, they at least believed that something happened. Whether or not that thing happened, we can know for certain that they believe something happened. But when you look at the likelihood of something like a psychological phenomenon of like a post-traumatic stress hallucination, right, the 25% of people have some sort of hallucination that they experience somebody that they cared about dying. But what if all it took was for simply Peter to have a similar type hallucination that's been well documented in psychology, pretty close to after this happened, and then Paul to have it a year or two later, or whenever he was, you know, persecuting Christians, this guilt overwhelms him, and then he hallucinates seeing this person that he was persecuting, right? What if the possibility is that only one or two people actually saw Jesus, and then those stories started to spread, and they claimed a resurrection Jesus, and the disciples were so immersed in that belief that they wanted to continue to believe it, and then it grows and spreads like any other religion does? But all it takes is one or two people to have an experience where they believe something happens for it to spread like we see in any other religion.
Brian, what's your response there?
Yeah, no, first, a couple points on that. The first thing is that whole premise seems a bit ad hoc, because especially if you put Peter and Paul together, if you just went Peter, you could say, well, you know, 25% of people have these stress hallucinations. The thing is, trying to do psychoanalysis on history is that we can't get inside Peter or Paul's head to do any kind of brain scans or trauma to see if there was any trauma. But usually, and I'm not saying you're saying that, of course, but usually the person is able to distinguish, hey, I know that wasn't my husband who was in my room last night, even though they died a week ago. It was a vision that I had. I realized that I'm stressfully hallucinating. Peter and Paul... we'll start with Peter. Peter clearly believed it so much so that he went to his death. Now, with that being said, Paul is not a great example of that, because we're completely assuming that a guy who was, you know, a Pharisee of Pharisees, or, you know, best of the best when it came to that. He was the John Wick of Pharisees, essentially, right? You know, he was as good as it gets. He was all of a sudden overcome with grief. We just don't see... That seems a little unplausible to me. Now, I'm not saying it's impossible, but I also know that in that 1 Corinthians 15 formula he gives, that's not coming from him. He didn't write that originally. He's quoting something that was given to him. He starts with Peter, then the 12, then, you know, over 500
people. We could throw out Paul
time.
Then, because it's obvious that, you know, sure, something was happening and people had a belief before he even had his conversion. So,
but I think
idea of Peter that works too.
But it's fine though, because I think even with Peter though, you're having a named disciple talk about these experiences. You're having people saying, "Hey, go check it out. Go talk to these other 500 people." Where's Joseph Smith with him? It's, "Hey, you want to know about how I know this is true? Well, Heavenly Father told me. Well, how can we check it out? Trust me." Versus, no, go check this. You were there. Remember, we were there together. And we can talk about group hallucinations being, yes, we all experience a group hallucination, but it's not the same thing. We might, you might see Cthulhu and I might see a big elephant, but in our minds, we saw the same thing. But that's not clearly what's being described here in the Gospels or in Paul's writings.
And I think then that goes back to it goes back to that same, do we trust the Gospels and do we mm-hmm. trust the accounts of, if there's a claim that 500 people saw Jesus, an indirect claim, how do we know? Do we have any record of any one of those 500 people seeing Jesus coming back and saying, "Yes, I saw him in this way"? Or is there just a, "Oh, and by the way, he appeared to the 500.
I think,
cool. Could you name one of the 500, right? Claim than it is evidence.
Yeah, I think Luke points to that when he's talking about his ascension narrative. And when Luke and then his sequel in Acts, I think the author of Luke is talking about that moment, or they're talking about that moment where there are multiple people who are there and, "Hey, go check it out. They're still alive. You can go talk to them." And again, it is hard for us sometimes, 2100, oh my Lord, we're 2100 years away, whatever it is, to go back and think, well, how are we supposed to go check it out? But the initial audience was alive at the time.
This is an interesting point that Brian's making here, Zach, differentiating, I suppose, from the Joseph Smith example, even arguably the Muhammad example, where it was again a personal vision, a revelation, the God that led to the Quran and so on. These were, in a sense, public events, and there's that old sort of thing, if it wasn't true, the authorities could have quelled this uprising by simply producing a dead body. But it's kind of the public nature of it that obviously Brian feels is somewhat different to the other examples of religions that got going in those ways.
I think the challenge, though, is that you could think about that idea of, sure, if these events happened in a public forum and in a way where people were around who have witnessed them, at what point who do you believe, right? Let's say this happened, right? That Jesus was actually killed and crucified and there were people here who witnessed it. And then a year or two later, there's just a group of people going around claiming he resurrected. And then you go back and you talk with some of the people who are like, "No, I was there and that didn't happen." "Oh, but no, this did happen." And then who do you believe, right? We don't have any stories from people who might not have believed it. We don't have any unbiased sources. The only sources and stories we have are the people who already believed it. So I'm curious, it could have happened where it's a public event, but who do you believe at that point if some people are in public saying, "No, this didn't happen," and some people are in public saying this did? If we only have a few sources from people saying it did, there could have been plenty of people in public who were like, "No, this didn't actually happen. These guys are crazy." But the stories continue to circulate to the point that became more believable.
I would say two things on that. One is that you would really rarely... You don't have a history written down, a narrative of why, Caesar didn't cross the Rubicon. "Oh, no, he didn't. Here's my book about why Caesar didn't cross," whatever it is. There are very few. You can't think of an example of something that didn't happen, why you would get that written down. But I get what you're saying with that. But the second example in that would still go to Paul and James. I mean, they're not priors. They're not people who believed in Jesus ahead of time. Yet they completely, Paul's one of the most influential atheist, Christian alike. Paul's one of the most influential people in all of human history. I mean, if you think about it, from what one man wrote down, if you take it as truth or not, we're still talking about it today, as a guy who I think everybody would agree this person existed in the Apostle Paul, whether you agree with what he wrote or not. I mean, it's incredible to think, someone who was an enemy.
Thinking about it in an analogous form of about maybe the conspiracy that the moon landings were fake, for example, right? Yeah, this is something where if you believe the moon landing is fake, you could go talk to somebody who was there. You could go talk to somebody who was in NASA in the 60s and actually sent those astronauts there. You could talk to the people who are alive. But if you have somebody that completely believes that the moon landing was fake, you could even talk to those people and still not be convinced. Right, so it's sort of that same idea of sure, whether this happened or not, this is not me saying this definitely proves or disproves either way. This is presenting a theory just as much as the resurrection is a possible explanation. this just seems more possible.
Okay, well, let's come to that next, maybe, because I think that's the sticking point, is whether a miracle counts as a satisfactory explanation, full stop. It'd be interesting to return to that in a moment, because in a sense, you're both in the miracle business. You know, you do things that just look completely miraculous on stage. And it's that, and I suppose the interesting thing is, you know, is that what happened in, you know, the first century? People got the wrong end of the stick. People were fooled, essentially, by something. So we'll come back to this in just a moment's time. We're asking, is Christianity, is the resurrection even a trick of the mind? Easter is only just behind us. So we're doing it a little bit of a discussion on both of those issues on today's show. My guests are Zach Pinsince and Brian Drake, and we'll be here with our final part of our discussion in just a moment. Hey, welcome back to today's edition of the show. Great to have you with us here on Unbelievable. Returning to the conversation between Zach and Brian in just a short moment's time. Next week on the show, we're asking, do Muslims and Christians worship the same God? That's the title of Andy Bannister's new book. And he's joining me to debate that question with Archbishop Josiah Idowu-Firon from Nigeria, who's got a lot of experience in Christian-Muslim relations and says, yes, he does believe Christians and Muslims worship the same God. And he says, no, he doesn't think that's the way we should look at things. So look out for that on next week's show. Coming up later on this evening on The Profile at 8 p.m, actor David Oyelowo is featured in the latest Premier Christianity magazine. He's a star of the big screen, and you'll be able to hear his story, his Christian faith, and amazing career in film on The Profile this evening. You can also hear my conversation with Mark Clark of the Village Church Vancouver again about his life and ministry and new book, The Problem of Jesus. But you can also listen to all of that on The Profile podcast, wherever you get your podcast from. Also want to give a shout out to the fact that we did launch this C.S. Lewis podcast over the Easter weekend as well. Alistair McGrath and Ruth Jackson sitting down every week to discuss all things C.S. Lewis. Now, we had a few problems initially getting all of the podcast platforms to accept the podcast just at the time we wanted to release it. But it's all there now, whether you're listening via Apple or Google or Podbean or wherever you choose to get your podcast from, you should be able to find the C.S. Lewis podcast with Alistair McGrath. Go and download it now. I think you're really going to enjoy it. And finally, just before we go into final part of our discussion, quick shout out for Unbelievable Live, Saturday 15th of May. Go and check out all of the topics that we've now uploaded to our website, unbelievable.live. And if you're not yet booked in, why not do so and join the many others who are going to be joining us for that conference on the 15th of May.
You're listening to Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Welcome back to the final part of this week's discussion. Zach Pinsince and Brian Drake have both joined me. Zach is a hypnotist. You can check him out on TikTok. He's got a big following there, at Zach Pinsince. I'll make sure there are links from today's show. You can also find him elsewhere on social media, YouTube and so on. Brian Drake Show is where you go for Brian, and he's got a brilliant act that he tours all over the place. Well, he does under normal circumstances. That has changed a bit, hasn't it, in the last year, I'm sure, Brian. But I suppose when you talk to someone like Zach, and I guess you meet other people who are skeptical, and you know, you've, I'm sure, come across many stories like Zach's of people who have fallen away from faith because they've been presented with objections and they just haven't been able to, you know, find something that meets them. I guess the question that often strikes me, Brian, is how much evidence does someone need? And that can probably vary quite a lot on the individual. And in a way, at what point do you as a Christian, Brian, have to say, well, I've got enough to satisfy me, but actually I'm not going to have, you know, all the evidence that most skeptics will want, but there's obviously a line at which you feel, no, I'm satisfied. I'm happy to say I can believe this intelligently, and I don't have to have, you know, X amount of evidence in order to support that. So you obviously find that line somewhere different to where Zach's now finding it, Brian.
Yeah, absolutely. And you hear Dr. Craig talk about this, but the indwelling of the Holy Spirit's a big deal for me. Like I all of these things, these evidences to me are convincing regardless, but the fact that in my own life, how Christ has impacted me personally and even through the last year, being able to look back and see how his providing for us. You know, my wife had cancer this past year in the middle of the pandemic. I mean, as we were shutting down, we had to drop her off. I couldn't even go in and visit her. She had thyroid cancer and they took it out. She's doing great now. But even in the midst of all that, in the midst of all those storms, there was a peace in knowing that God was, you know, his hand was in it. And even though I'm not a Calvinist, what we do on stage feels a lot more like Calvinism sometimes, in the idea that I'm already going to predetermine what's going to happen before this is over anyway. You're going to pick the red one, trust me. But at the end of the day, I do feel that that evidence is there. I do feel that even the minimal facts, like we talked about earlier, that's kind of a, it's a thing that obviously gets talked about on every podcast or every episode just about the resurrection. But I do feel that that evidence is strong historically, especially when it comes to others. Now, yes, it does involve me accepting the leap of having a miracle be involved. But again, I think there's a great cumulative case for the existence of God. And if that God exists, and this person Jesus claims to be that God, I mean, I can't see how it's not possible that that could be an explanation. And again, I'm aware that that makes me take the leap in logic and have the burden of proof in that. I fully accept that. I'm willing to do that.
Yeah, yeah. I suppose it all leaves me wondering, Zach, for you, what kind of evidence would be required, in a sense, to accept a miraculous claim? I mean, not just of the resurrection, I suppose, anything. It sounds like you're saying there, you know, any naturalistic explanation is more probable than a miracle. Therefore, you're always going to prefer that kind of an explanation, which is obviously a major change. It feels like it's not just that someone put some objections to the resurrection in your path. It feels like you've kind of had quite a major worldview change about what you're willing to countenance, almost as an explanation of anything in that sense, Zach.
Yeah, and I think that's because I've learned and I've realized how much more our confirmation bias or predisposition beliefs can lead us to assuming that what we believe is true. And so to me, like, I want to believe what is true. And if I come across enough evidence or enough things that would make me believe that God is real or Jesus is real or did resurrect, then that's something that I want to believe, right? Some people, a lot of my Christian friends or family have assumed, oh, you just didn't want to believe in God, so you just decided not to. Like, I want to believe what's true. I want to believe what's most consistent with what is real, right? The C.S. Lewis quote of Christianity, if true, is of the utmost importance, and if false, is of no importance. The only thing it can't be is moderately important. So if it is true, I want to believe it. I'm not predispositioned to think that, oh, sure, yeah, if God's real, I wouldn't want to worship him anyway because he's this cruel, mean monster, right? I want to believe what's true. Even if he was a cruel, mean monster, if you're a supernatural being that controls the universe, then more power to you, literally, you have that, right?
What's fascinating in all this is it is quite recent. You know, only about a year ago you kind of formally started to think of yourself as an atheist. But was it a struggle to get there? I mean, was there a kind of, do you miss God in a sense? Because it sounds like you're being quite logical about this. But then when I hear Brian say, I look at the way my life kind of, you know, makes sense in light of God. And obviously he sees this as not just about pure evidence, but a life that's been lived in this kind of relationship. I mean, presumably you felt you had all that. Did you manage to kind of leave that behind quite easily, ultimately, when you did kind of step across the line?
Well, like I mentioned earlier, I was in this process of sort of reconstructing what my faith looked like. And I was trying to decide, well, how do I actually experience that? Or what does it look like to tangibly follow God in my everyday life? And how do I go about doing that? And so was more open to questioning things, which is part of why it was a little bit easier for me to leave it behind. It wasn't one day I was doing everything and going to church all the time and praying and in Bible studies and just snap my fingers and suddenly I'm the world's biggest atheist, right? It's still this process of me being willing. Yeah, right, exactly. It was me being willing to question the beliefs, question maybe if what happened already was a form of hypnosis, where I was so immersed in what I thought to be true, I was never willing to entertain the other side of it. And I think that's the biggest thing, is that we all want to be as intellectually honest as possible. But I think what's most fascinating is that there are going to be people listening to this conversation that will hear everything that all of us have said. And there'll be some people who will hear everything and say, this makes me want to follow God more. And there'll be those same people who will hear the exact same words and say, this makes me want to be an atheist more. How do you hear the exact same conversation and it can lead to two different
conclusions? I've had that experience many times on this show. You've described exactly what happens very frequently, as the host, I'm sure. And I can have a listener get in touch and say, wow, the Christian absolutely won the day on that one. And the very same show, someone else gets in touch and say, the atheist wiped the floor with that guy. And exactly. But Brian, where does this leave us? Because obviously, in the end, we're all coming to the evidence, you know, whether we be Zach as an atheist, you as a Christian, whatever, with a certain amount of, you know, psychological baggage, for want of a better word. So it's impossible, in a sense, to come as a completely clean slate, isn't it, in that way?
Yeah, I mean, we all do have priors that we carry with us no matter what. And so in order to even just, I guess the only suggestion and the only advice I could leave people with, and this is what we do in our show, is just be willing at least, and it honestly echoes a lot what Zach just said, be willing at least to hear the evidence, but also, again, I believe that the Holy Spirit is real. I believe that the Holy Spirit will draw you to Him. And if that happens, I would implore you, you know, please, I mean, that's my heart, is to see people come to know Christ. If that's you, if that's your situation, and you're hearing this, and you're hearing the gospel, and you're thinking, I need Jesus in my life, then don't reject it. Don't push it away. Don't think, well, maybe we'll just try it later, or I'll try doing this, or maybe I'll try on that Jesus stuff like a shirt, but really embrace it and be open to that in your life and that personal experience of Jesus in your life.
We are going to have to leave it there, guys. It's been a really interesting discussion between the both of you. Thank you very much. So much more that could have been said, as ever. You can always search back in the archives if you want more great debates on the resurrection. As Brian mentioned, actually, we've had some really interesting conversations between people like Mike Lacona, Bart Ehrman, and some of those Bible scholars who bring the academic stuff as well. But it's really interesting to trace, you know, both of your journeys as well as stage hypnotists and illusionists as well. Again, if you want to find out more about Zach, at Zach Pinsince, and at Brian Drake Show for Brian as well, to find out more. But for the moment, thank you both for joining me on today's show.
Well, thank you.
It was a lot of fun. Thanks for having me.
Well, if you'd like to tell me what you made of today's show, do feel free to email unbelievable@premier.org.uk. You can also get in touch via our social medias at UnbelievableJB for the Twitter, facebook.com/UnbelievableJB to follow the show on Facebook. You can find me over on Instagram as well, justin.briley. And that's also my TikTok as well. And apparently someone discovered me recently on TikTok. Isaias got in touch to say, just finished your audiobook while at the gym today. Such a great read. Most of the topics you talked about, I've already learned from reading books from people like John Lennox and C.S. Lewis, who you mentioned. But I loved how you described suffering and the question of why, because that's what I had struggled tackling in a world of chaos and destruction. You remind me of 1 Peter 3:15, because with your book, you're preparing individuals to give an answer to why we as Christians have hope. Keep on making the TikToks, because that's how I found you. Thank you very much, Isaias. Great to hear from you. Glad you've enjoyed Unbelievable, Why, After 10 Years of Talking with Atheists, I'm Still a Christian. And by the way, you can still get signed copies of the book through our own Premier website. So make sure to check out the links from the show page if you want to do that at premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. But the audiobook is also an option too. Just want to say, before I move on to some of the other comments we've had in and reactions to last week's show, especially between Bishop Barron and Alex O'Connor, we had a lovely time going along to this Spring Harvest discussion event this last Tuesday evening. It was great to see all the people who have logged on online for Spring Harvest this year. Normally, big Christian conference will be happening in the UK over the Easter period, obviously not happening this year due to COVID, but great to see the way they've brought together so many great speakers and pieces of content for this sort of online conference they've been hosting each day in the past week. And great to be joined for that discussion event by Tim Hughes, well-known worship leader, Moiwa, who's the head of Premier Gospel and a wonderful gospel artist and broadcaster himself. Also, Graham Nichols joined us from Affinity Network, and my own wife, Lucy Briley, was also on that particular discussion, joining me in the studio in Reading, where we were. So that was real fun, and you'll be able to hear that and watch that on the Unbelievable channels in a few weeks' time. But if you were If you were watching along with those who were attended Spring Harvest Online this past week, then a big hello to you and thanks for tuning in. Lovely to hear from Taylor as well, who got in touch to say, you guys put on a blue chip show. Now, I don't know what that actually means. What is a blue chip show? I'm going to assume it's a compliment, though, Taylor. So thank you very much. You say, I've enjoyed listening to the extensive backlog. A theme that seems scant in today's Christian discussions is veganism. I searched your episodes and listened to the only episode that tangentially touched on this. It was on animal suffering. It'd be great if you could get a couple of top-notch speakers to debate it. I do not have a pro-animal eating Christian in mind, but a UK-based group where you might find a pro-vegan Christian is Sark. org.uk. Hope you take me up on this. I think we will, Taylor. We've had over the years a few requests for a debate on veganism and vegetarianism. In fact, one of our speakers last week is a big vegan activist, Alex O'Connor, as well as being our atheist on last week's show. And I'm sure he'd welcome some kind of conversation as well, because that's really almost become a bigger deal in terms of his YouTubing and debating is the veganism side of what Alex does. Let's turn to that show from last week. It was the first episode of our season three of The Big Conversation. Bishop Robert Barron, Alex O'Connor, both big names in the world of online atheism and Christianity, got together to discuss whether Christianity or atheism makes best sense of who we are. That meant they were debating arguments for God's existence, the nature of faith, and indeed suffering was very much the theme towards the end of the show. Here's some of the tweets that you sent in. Fabian said, thanks, Justin, for continuing to build bridges when so many continue to push us to burn them. So refreshing and reassuring to know that sensible adults can engage in respectful dialogue while holding fundamentally opposite views. I loved the show. Greg Anderson said, unbelievable, such an incredible example of how thought leaders and influencers who are diametrically opposed on various topics can be civil while expressing their values and opinions. Hashtag listen and learn. Hashtag well done. Thank you very much, Greg. Tom wanted to say, Alex came out on top for me, but I would say that as I'm an atheist. Well, it's kind of you to sort of say, you know, where your biases lie and why you probably came out with Alex on that one, Tom. But having said that, I often hear from Christians who say, I thought the atheist did a better job this week, or vice versa. So it doesn't necessarily follow. Christian Salzillo said, the new episode of The Big Conversation from Unbelievable did not disappoint. Bishop Barron is a tremendous voice within Christianity, and O'Connor struck me as a decent and kind guy. Great convo, super episode. And finally on Twitter, Seriously Though Wear a Mask, that's what they're calling themselves anyway, said, this was an interesting discussion. Both sides clarified points that were not understood by either. I got the impression, though, that Alex is open, but seeking something more tangible to attach to belief. Well, that's a bit like trying to attach a thing to the concept of trust, says Seriously Though Wear a Mask. Thank you very much. Here's some longer responses that came in on email as well. So Brendan says, listening to Alex O'Connor, I found it surprising that as bright as he is, he couldn't fathom a scenario where an evil such as COVID could be a good thing brought forth by God in the long run. Listening to a member of the US pandemic response team, they were moderately prepared for something of COVID's magnitude. The pandemic hypothetically could have been much worse, say killing around 50% of people, like the Black Death did in Europe. With the globe being more connected by the year, pandemics are occurring more frequently. It's quite possible that a future pandemic could be much worse, and that COVID was the world's warning sign to get their act together. Thus, the millions of deaths now are the alarm to save billions of lives in the future due to changing and action. Death is inevitable due to man's sin, but if God's objective is to have as many people as possible come to him, this seems to me a very plausible explanation for the existence of COVID. Obviously, I could be wrong, but outright dismissing any possible reason seems to me a premature conclusion. I was surprised it was such a sticking point for Alex. Thanks, Brendan, for weighing in on that. Jeff says, I was gripping my seat listening to the last half of this conversation. Bishop Barron was gracious in how he didn't push Alex on the atheist contribution to helping suffering, but simply gave Alex the benefit of not having to give counsel to the hundreds of thousands of people suffering under COVID. If God, this limit, past our limit, doesn't exist, then there'd be no reason to push back against suffering on behalf of others. But if no one gave counsel because they have no reasonable way to answer, then we'd be even more miserable. So Alex holds a worldview that increases misery in his silence. Alex, I felt, made some shifty moves when pressing Bishop Barron on celebrating evil when he asks, is this bad? Then turns and makes Bishop Barron's answer refer to the state of the universe, as opposed to the limited view, which Bishop Barron had made abundantly clear. Integrity goes a long way in supporting one's arguments. And I felt that slip undermined Alex's position. But thanks for the great conversations. Thank you. Leslie Ann gets in touch to say, thanks for another fascinating discussion. It's so refreshing to hear people discussing atheism and Christianity in a mutually respectful way, in stark contrast, sadly, to much online content. My particular observation on the problem of evil and suffering is that there's a fundamental difference between an atheistic and Christian understanding of the nature of the human experience. In assessing whether human suffering is so great as to mean that any creator God cannot be good, it matters whether or not you believe that a human life is limited to a certain amount of time in a physical body, or whether human experiences is, for a time, bounded by physicality, but then later freed into a non-physical divine reality, where physical pain and suffering no longer exists. The calculation as to whether the suffering in human life can be offset by the goods is profoundly affected by which understanding one adopts. When the differences are not made explicit, the debate tends to revolve around a purely materialist perspective. A Christian theology of hope can deal much better with the problem of suffering, I would contend, than can a materialist perspective. With grateful appreciation, Leslie Ann Weir. Leslie, thank you for listening and for that really interesting response. Here's another one from William Sykes, who says, what's up, Justin? Just finished listening to the latest episode. A few thoughts on Alex's points about coronavirus and Christians having to celebrate it. This scripture continually went through my mind during that conversation. Romans 8:28. And we know that all things work together for good to them that love God, to them who are called according to his purpose. I don't understand why the bishop allowed Alex to put all of the suffering associated with coronavirus on the back of Christianity, when the Bible itself only makes the claim that everything includes suffering, yields a positive result for the believer specifically. I would have made the point that there is a suffering that leads to good, and also suffering that doesn't necessarily have to be just dumb suffering. Yes, Christians and atheists alike have suffered from the coronavirus. However, one cannot say if the results of the atheist and Christian suffering will be the same. It seems Alex is looking for a positive result on a grand scale where everyone could easily recognize it as good, whereas the good could come to the Christian in a much smaller, more personal way, in a way that's only good for the individual, not the entirety of everyone suffering because of coronavirus. And here's another one from Howell Ferreira. And Howell, I think I'm pronouncing your name right. I apologize if I'm not. But you're writing in from sunny Lisbon. So you say, a fan of the show Unbelievable, the discussions have helped me through my own extended road to Damascus, or from materialist atheist to mere Christian. I feel like I'm still on the road, but the show has been a great help steering me towards God. Thank you. Always exciting to hear about those kinds of journeys. So thank you so much for telling me, Howell. Anyway, you say, I'm writing about the recent discussion between O'Connor and Bishop Barron. Must confess, I was looking forward to the debate, but found it disappointing. As I listened to the conversation, I was frustrated with the discussion around natural tragedy and so-called overarching moral good. Both participants failed to address two key points that I think clear up common misconceptions about providence and the problem of evil. Firstly, free will and freedom. There's no overarching plan or moral good that can be revealed when we adopt a godlike perspective. God does not allow tragedy to occur in order to generate some good further down the line. That would mean God was like an author sitting down writing a novel in complete control over each character's destiny and the overall plot. But God did not create us to be automata or lifeless characters in a book. He gave us free will to decide for ourselves. But what good is there in deciding if all is already predetermined according to some cosmic plan? In the show, Alex and Bishop Barron discussed the particular example of the current coronavirus pandemic. Why does God allow it? Can good ever come out of it? I must agree with Alex that there is no good coming out of it. And as a Christian, I don't believe that God allows suffering in the name of a greater good. But if God is almighty, why doesn't he intervene? Well, let's say God does intervene and wipes out coronavirus. But what about AIDS then? What about people dying from the common cold? What moral is there in saving some and not others? Well, one might then argue, why did God create a world in which illness exists in the first place? That's a good question, and one made repeatedly by atheists and believers alike. But here's a possible answer. Any parent feels a mixture of love and dread when holding a newborn baby. How beautiful and peaceful they are, but also how fragile, how terrifyingly vulnerable. Here's the critical point. If you had the power, would you make your baby daughter 12 feet tall and replace her skin with titanium? And in doing so, Would you then still love her? Or would some crucial aspect of your love perish in such a transformation? God feels the same about us. He loves us like his children. He suffers when we needlessly die. It's not his will that we perish to the coronavirus. It's just a part of the wonder and tragedy of being alive and therefore vulnerable. Human vulnerability is part of the beauty of existence. Yes, there is tragedy, but still there is the beauty of transcending human limitation. The beauty of existence, of being, is also to be found in the miracle of transcending our vulnerability, our limitations. If God had made us imperishable, immune to all harm, forever protected from ill by no merit of our own, wouldn't that be akin to never letting our children play outside for fear of them getting hurt? There is no love in an overbearing father who cripples his children by never letting them grow and take chances. And it goes on in like manner. So it's quite a lengthy email here, Hal, but I was interested in all of the points that you made in that. Thank you very much. And glad to hear that the show has been helpful in your own developing journey as well. Well, that's a smattering, really, of what came in response to the big conversation. You're still welcome to send your thoughts in, unbelievable@premier.org.uk. Always interested to hear what you made of the show. And don't forget, you can get in touch as well via our other ways as well, our social media and so on. I've also had lots of other comments in, because we haven't had much time for feedback in recent weeks, on shows on doubt. We had Logan and Ben the week before talking about that. And this from David in Oz says, thanks for hosting an interesting discussion between Logan and Ben. Ben did a fantastic job responding to Logan's points about why he lost his faith, I thought. I couldn't have done so on the spot nearly as well as Ben. However, there was one thing I think Ben missed. To respond to Logan saying at different times, both that in the Old Testament, God did or commanded things that Logan now thinks are evil, but also that the Bible is just stories that the Jews made up. Logan here, to me, is apparently falling into the fallacy that much of the new atheism falls into, that states, there is no God, and I hate him. If there truly is no God, there's just no point criticising what he's done. And Logan needs to decide, are the Bible stories all fairy tales and there's no God at all? Or is there a true God of the Old Testament manifested in Jesus, but is it just that Logan doesn't like him? I hope and pray Logan can find his faith again. He'd be welcome back with open arms. That's David in Newcastle, Australia, who get in touch about that. One final one. This is from Chris. And this was actually in response to Shelby Abbott, who Ruth Jackson interviewed on the subject of doubt in a previous show. And Chris says, thanks again for the good content on Unbelievable. Really appreciating it down here in New Zealand. Thought I'd share a thought that came from that interview Ruth did, and particularly one thing he said that seemed a little strange at first. He was speaking about what he would say to Rhett and Link in light of their recently announced Deconstructed Faith and his history of working with them some years ago. One of the things he said was to do with the issue of them needing a changed heart given by God, and that with that you can't really say you have a deconstructed faith. My first thought was, well, how would that help, saying that to someone who has a deconstructed faith? But I remember my own intense experience with doubt over a couple of years and standing on the crossroads of atheism or continuing in Christian faith when I was at theological college. And something that really helped me in a very surprising and non-intuitive way, Brian Rosner, a lecturer of mine at the time, now principal of Ridley College, Melbourne, brought to my attention the words of Paul in 1 Corinthians 13 about being known by God as a reality, even if we're not sure we know him. He had an article on this idea in C.S. Lewis and Dietrich Bonhoeffer, and it's a poem in Bonhoeffer that's always stuck with me, the last lines of which I still often pray. Whoever I am, thou knowest, O God, I am thine. At first glance, the primacy of God's knowledge of us isn't much help when you're not sure God is even there. But strangely for me, I always found it helpful. The idea that God started this relationship, not me, actually felt freeing in a sense. It wasn't all on my shoulders to work it out. If God was there, his knowledge of me was going to be more important than my knowledge of him. And that seemed somehow to make things more manageable as I wrestled with the weight of huge questions. It didn't mean I could avoid them, yet somehow it made the questions seem less overwhelming as I tried to work through them. I'm not sure I would phrase things quite the way Shelby did if I was talking to Rhett and Lincoln, yet the basic idea that you need to be realistic, that if God is there, his knowledge of you and work in you is going to be more important than your understanding of him. And therefore, if you haven't understood him, it's worth asking if you have recognised that order of things. lives. I think that's worth putting across. It almost links with what Alistair McGrath was saying about John Polkinghorne's idea of congruence in the other interview on the show. It's more congruent with who we are as limited creatures than thinking of ourselves as the only agents in this relationship. You can only understand things well if you approach them in the right way. And it seems to me that approaching the possibility of God with the openness of him being the primary agent in our interactions is much more appropriate to, or more congruent with, what we know about ourselves and the kind of being we're investigating, if we're investigating God. Taking that attitude may make us better at understanding and more free to understand the God who just might be there. Anyway, it's gone on too long. I'll stop there. Thank you very much, Chris. Interesting thoughts. A lot of helpful thoughts there as well. Thank you, everyone who's been in touch. Sorry that I can't get to all of the feedback we get. It's been a bulging email inbox because we haven't actually brought you any of your feedback for the last few weeks. But we'll do so again in future shows, of course, and look forward to hearing more about today's programme. Let me know what you thought about Zach and Brian's interaction on whether Christianity is a trick of the mind. Email unbelievable@premier.org.uk, and you get in touch via the social media ways as per usual. For now, though, it's time to say thank you for being with me. Don't forget to get your place booked in for Unbelievable the Conference 2021, Saturday the 15th of May. Really excited by how many people are booking in and just the fantastic conversations we're going to be having on the day. Very much an interactive day. It's not just going to be people talking to a screen. We're making loads and loads of time for audience Q&A throughout the whole thing. So you're going to really feel like you're talking to the guests, Tom Wright, Tom Holland, and our other guests who are with us on the day. So well worth being part of it. Unbelievable.live to book your place. Right now, let me tell you what's coming up next week. Do Muslims and Christians worship the same God? That's the title of Andy Bannister's new book. Andy's been a regular guest on the show over the years. Now, my wife Lucy, she doesn't often read many of the apologetics books that land on my desk, but she read this one and she absolutely loved it. She found it so interesting and so helpful. So this one has the Lucy Briley seal of approval, but you can hear Andy in discussion on this question with Archbishop Josiah Iduwufiran from Nigeria. He's got a lot of experience in Christian-Muslim relations and says, yes, he thinks Christians and Muslims do worship the same God. You'll hear Andy's response to that, why he believes that's not the case, on next week's show. For now, thanks for being with us and see you next time.